This is Graham Hancock. You're listening to Earth Ancients with Cliff Dunning.
And a happy Saturday to you. This is Cliff. I hope you're doing well. Hey, for those of you that were trying to listen live, apparently there was some kind of a systems meltdown in New York. I was trying to get a hold of Rita. Rita couldn't hear me. I couldn't hear her. They were not getting any signal on the network. And so this is unfortunately, this is a pre-record just a few minutes after we tried to do it live. So apologies, but here we are. That's just the way it goes. And Blog Talk Network has its challenges. Hope you're doing well. It is Saturday, the 5th. We're into December already. And I hope you're doing well. Graham was on the program last week. I've had just a deluge of emails about questions for him, what he meant by some of his references to ancient culture, known, unknown, mostly unknown. And I've posted on our Facebook page quite a bit of information from other researchers that have followed a similar path. And for years, I was working and kind of corresponding with a gentleman in Russia, Andrei Skylarv, and he is part of the Laboratory of Alternative History. And I've posted a couple of his galleries of photos, and one of the ones that is really unique is the Japanese megaliths. And for all of you who have listened to the show, we had an expert on about a year ago who chronicled the unknown history of Japan. And they have areas in Japan where there's these monstrous stone works and carved reliefs of unknown age. And what Skylarf has sent me is these megaliths. And within these megaliths are the number of sarcophagus look just like or have similar machining to some of the Egyptian sarcophagus that we have seen, mostly in the Giza Plateau area. But if you go to Facebook and you look under Japanese megaliths, you'll see 200-plus photographs of a couple of specific areas. And the machine work on these, and the thing is, they don't know how old they are. You know, anthropologists, archaeologists like to say, well, you know, they're a couple of thousand years old. But when you really look closely at the top of this one domed sarcophagus, the machining, the carving is so precise. There's no way they could have done it with hand tools. It was done by some kind of a big automated precision driven tool that cuts knobs, cuts angles, cuts perfect corners on stone. And it's mind blowing. I hadn't seen these before. And this is what I've been trying to do, is continually place evidence of high technology prior to our understanding of history, or what I would call prehistory, on the website, on Facebook. So check that out. It's under Japanese megaliths, and it's from the Laboratory of Alternative History, which is Andrei Skylarf. So that's one goodie. The other thing I want to mention is Bruce Cunningham from Ancient Mysteries International sent some photographs of the Gunung Penang Pyramid. You know, he's currently on tour. And jump on Facebook Earth Ancients group page, and there are some really, really cool photographs of Dr. Danny Hillman climbing on the side of this pyramid, and these huge basalt stone blocks that are toppled in some strange manner. We have to ask Danny next time we have him on how those were toppled, because some of those stone blocks, they must weigh 10 to 20 tons each. And it would have to be a major force to move them in the manner they were moved. They're totally toppled. But anyhow, I'm hoping for Bruce to send us back some photos of this new dig that is getting into this first chamber. And if you listen to the show last week, Graham Hancock was mentioning that they had identified a couple of chambers, and this first one's about 30 feet below the top of the surface. And it's anyone's guess what they're going to find. It's about 18 feet high by about 30 feet wide. And they do not know what's in there. But it's odd because with a lot of these other pyramids, there's a strange emanation that they're detecting on with their equipment. And in the case of Gnom Penang, it's a pulse. It's a strange pulse. And about a year ago, I posted an article from some testing that Danny Hillman had done. And he was going to go back and retest the emanation, the geomagnetic field that was being pulsed out of this chamber. So fascinating. I mean, it's so mind-blowing when you think about the construction of these pyramids. Remember now that pyramid is currently dated at 20,000 years ago. Excuse me, 25. It's 20,000 BC, so it's older than 20,000 years ago. And they continue to get dates that go further back, and that's only the second level, and there's 3+ levels to that pyramid. So could go back, I think it's estimated it could go back 30 to 40,000 years. And we were supposed to be, you know, very primitive at that time. And here we are with a sophisticated, engineered, well-designed pyramid with inner chambers that are pulsing energy. So I think we got something to learn about that. Check it out, Earth Ancients, Facebook, the group page. The interview with Graham was fascinating for me, but of course it's only about an hour. He has promised to come back and follow up that interview with another one that specifically covers the Younger Dryas period, which is this period that now scientists believe was the devastation that wiped out whatever civilizations were on the planet. That could have been the one that wiped out Atlantis, is a good probability, and any other advanced technology that was on the planet. In his new book, Magicians of the Gods, which I am looking at and reading currently, huge section on this cataclysm. And he mentions the work of Randall Carlson. Randall's going to be on the show hopefully this month, but he's traveling right now, so we may not have him till January. But the devastation that took place on Earth is now quite easily seen via satellite photography. And, you know, Randall's going to tell us all about what happened, but, you know, who were the people that were living before us? You know, who were these individuals? What is the evidence? You know, Graham shows us evidence at Baalbek, Lebanon with these megaliths. I believe there's evidence throughout Central America. Graham talks a little bit about the Olmec, the Maya, Aztec, and other civilizations that were descendants from probably a mix of other high-cultured individuals. I mean, if you really look at the Maya, I firmly believe this, and the elders who I've spoken with believe it the same thing too. They inherited their technology. They inherited their engineering science. I mean, when you go to the Yucatan and you climb on any of those pyramids, Chichen Itza, Uxmal, down in Tikal, if they let you climb in Tikal, those pyramids in Tikal are amazing. Those are engineering feats where someone with a mathematical background, with an engineering, constructional engineering background, this was handed down to them. It wasn't just You know, it wasn't just like, oh, they figured it out on their own. You can't figure something like that out on your own. And the other thing is, if you study Mayan culture, there isn't really a inception period where they started developing pyramid technology, pyramid building. It just appears. It appears out of nowhere. And that's just doesn't make sense. That doesn't work like that. They had to have inherited that engineering skill from some other people, from other culture. And for years, it was thought that the Olmec predated the Maya. Now, recent carbon dating shows that the Maya were contemporaries to the Olmec, lived at the same time, and they did a lot of exchange of probably culture, of thought and engineering, mathematics, who knows what else. But the Maya talk about, you know, star people. They talk about elders, and I've spoken to a number of elders who say in their culture they did have a period where there were gods. You know that on this program I don't encourage, and I have a real hard time with the ancient alien theory. But at some point you've got to really start considering it now. For those of you who have been following the program, I'm a big, big proponent of Mars. And not only have we had experts on it, like Dr. John Brandenburg, who shows us that there was a devastation on the planet millions and millions of years ago, but also guys like Mike Barra, who have revealed the structural engineering and the actual buildings that are left to us on the surface of the planet. But these other native cultures, the Native Americans and the Chinese and other cultures that have been on the planet for thousands and thousands of years, have a mythological background, have lores, have folk tales of gods, goddesses, and individuals who left their prints on them and may have left other evidence of their being here through buildings that we just don't know about yet. So, and the thing about ancient aliens, let's face it, everything that cannot be explained, they say, is aliens. And personally, and Graham's the same way, Graham Hancock, he's like, so that just gets out of hand. You know, it's like, oh, okay, pyramids are here. We don't know who really built them. It wasn't Khufu. Oh, it's ancient aliens. No, it gets old. It gets old. That gets old. We want to hear some more solid evidence that it's from, you know, star beings. You know, it's just really, really, really easy to use that as an excuse. But my guest today has written a fascinating book. My guest today is Rita Louise, and she wrote a book with a gentleman named Wayne, and I'm probably going to butcher this last name. It's Lela Berte. And the book's called The E.T. Chronicles, What Myths and Legends Tell Us About Human Origins, which is a really cool title. And I've been looking at this book, and it's fascinating how it's composed. And they did a really, really good job on it. And I've invited Rita to come on the program and talk a little bit about that. And we have her with us right now. Hi, Rita. How are you?
Hey, Cliff. How's it going? I am great. It is so nice to hear a voice that goes with that Facebook face.
Well, great to have you. Hey, you know, this is quite an interesting book for a lot of reasons. You guys did a really great job in composing the components. And actually, I want to open this with a quote that I'm going to take from the introduction. This is very interesting what you wrote here. This is a quote. With our research concluded and the pieces of the puzzle put into place, we were left with one unalterable conclusion. The folklore, legends, and traditions we are about to share with you are not humanity's stories about the gods. Instead, the gods' stories about their lives, their exploits, and themselves. And what a story they tell. That's a fascinating ending. It's actually the prelude to what the reader is going to read. What did you mean by that? Did you mean that there's evidence of Zeus or one of these Mayan gods talking about where they came from, or what? What does that mean?
Well, they don't talk about where they came from per se, but what I meant, and you know, what I ended up ferreting out in a later article that I written that's available on my website, soulhealer.com, was was looking at the, and I'm going to say literary style, and the point of view of the author. Okay, so when we talk about things, we talk about it from our perspective. And so when you start looking at mythology, we find basically, or this is how I formatted, we have early cosmology, and then what I consider the late mythological stuff. And where that line really falls in is, and I'm going to say after the flood, with the rise of the demigods, where we have stories of Hercules and Perseus and Jason and the Argonauts, where we have those stories,
right.
Those stories are told from the perspective of humanity, and humanity looks up at the gods as being divine characters. And it's a very consistent point of view. Prior, and I hate using the flood, but it's a really strong demarcation line. Anything prior to that, it's the stories of the gods about the gods. Because for the majority of the history, mankind didn't exist. I mean, in writing that book, you know, we just kind of went where the narration took us. And the creation of humanity is like the second to last chapter. And so we have all of this mythological narrative that's happening before humanity. Okay, other little piece to it. One of the things that one of my soapbox items, and I keep bringing up from different points of view, like my movie Icon, Deconstructing the Archetypes of the Ancients, looks at it from another perspective, is the commonality narrative that we find. And there would be no way if it was individual cultures writing about their experiences with these mythological, artificial, we just made this stuff up material. There's no way.
Interesting. So the question I have to ask is, what was the compelling reason for writing a book like this? Was it the fact that you, as a researcher, author, radio host, and you've interviewed, you know, hundreds of people on the ET question, on aliens, on UFOs and things like that? I mean, was it just like, okay, I got to find this out. I got to find out where this originates. Were we, you know, what was the motivation?
The whole thing started with the whole end of the Mayan calendar deal. And it was like in 2009, and we were watching a show on History Channel or whatever that was talking about the Mayan calendar. And, of course, you know, we talked to the TV because we always had this, you know, ongoing line of commentary for stupid TV shows. And and one of the things they said that really intrigued me in particular, they were talking about the Mayan calendars and the five cycles, and we're coming to the end of the cycle, and then they said, and they say the same things in Egypt and in India or something to that effect. And I thought, you know, we ended up having a conversation after the show, and I said, well, you know, I don't remember what they said about these other cultures. So the show thankfully aired again, and we watched it again, and basically they just made this one-line comment, and they didn't explore what these other cultures talked about. So I started digging into what the narrative from India was about the different cycles of time, because, I mean, I had heard of the Yuga cycles and was vaguely, you know, familiar enough to talk about them, but not really dig into it. And I found out that what they were saying on TV was kind of a lot of crap, but that's okay. You know, but moving on, one of the things that I found in that cosmology was a story that sounded very similar to the Noah story. And we can go into that down the road, but it just started me digging into the whole flood narrative, which I ended up finding you know, I don't want to say hundreds, but a lot of narratives from around the world, and found out that they all had basically the same storyline, which, again, we can go into. So I said, you know, I think I really want to explore this, maybe put this, you know, see where it goes. I didn't know. But realized that by the time we got to the flood narrative, we were already very late in this game, and decided we needed to go to, quote unquote, in the beginning and work our way forward. And what ended up happening was, I mean, the best way to explain it was I mentally created this Excel spreadsheet with in the beginning here, the flood narrative kind of at the end, on the other side of the Excel spreadsheet, because after the flood, it's pretty obvious what happened, you know, even though we talk about it in the book. And yeah. I wanted to see if I could find common mythological subjects that transcended culture to start filling in these gaps. And so I'll stop there.
So tell me, let's talk about flood narrative right now, because it is important. Okay. You bring it up in your book quite a bit. And I think the compelling evidence is that you reveal multiple cultures kind of repeating the same story in similar fashion. It's not like clockwork, but they're pretty similar, aren't they?
They're remarkably similar. I mean, I'm not going to tell the Noah story because I think everybody's familiar with that.
Mm-hmm.
But one of my favorite ones comes out of Peru, and it talks about, now, listen to the characters, listen to the cadence of the story, just these little weird details. It talks about these two brothers who are they're righteous brothers, who are warned about an impending flood by their llama. Okay, weird detail. And they climb to the top of the mountain with their wife and their children. The waters come, the mountain rises, and as the waters recede, the mountain goes back down. And so they survive the flood. You know, and so when you look at all of these narratives, what we find is that there is a righteous, virtuous, or pious man who is warned of this flood. He builds a boat, an ark, digs a canoe, climbs on a leaf, climbs up a tree, climbs to the top of the mountain. He survives the flood with his wife, maybe his sister. Sometimes there's an old man. Sometimes children survive. In a few of the narratives, which I found really interesting, they were miscellaneously dispersed around the world. Animals survive. And in a subset of those, sometimes an animal is released, not always a bird, but an animal to let them know that the waters have receded. And so even the ones that they're not in a boat or on some kind of flotation device, if you think about it, Noah's Ark landed on the top of Mount Ararat. So we do have this mountain tie to that story. Cliff, I have to tell you, when I started doing this research, I had a notebook, and I just started writing things, you know, like, who was warned, you know, how did they survive, and I just made, like, headings, and I thought I would have pages and pages and pages and pages of little subsets, and I ended up with, like, maybe 15 columns, and of those 15 columns, I was able to even condense it more into one paragraph.
Oh, okay. So it's haiku time.
You know, and it's interesting because we wrote the book, and there's a gentleman whose name is Michael Witzel, who is a professor emeritus at Yale. I think it's Yale. I don't know, a very prestigious university, who wrote this book that's like 500 pages long, and he came to the same conclusion. And I love his book. I mean, you know, it's one of them scholarly books. But he and where we went was exactly the same. And I'm like, well, I feel kind of proud. You know, he's got like all kinds of letters and degrees and specializations.
Yeah.
And
cool.
I'm just me.
Cool. So can you tell us if it's typical in the various versions of the flood for the people of Earth to be warned of an impending doom, or is it more like it just happened and you're screwed, just, you're going to have to ride it out, folks?
They're always warned.
Okay.
Always.
Okay. So let's go back a little further before the flood. Can you define a God? I mean, when I think of God, and you bring this up in your book, which I love, the fact that you kind of have Star Trek in there, where you have like the advanced, extremely advanced technology coming to a very poorly developed or a slow to develop planet. And here's these guys flying in light ships and so on and so forth. You kind of give reference to that. I mean, it's obvious, and I do believe that our planet has been visited and may continue to be visited, but I don't use that as a strong point to describe a lot of the ruins of advanced civilizations that are here, but who knows? I mean, when you think of a God, when you describe a God, when you did research on gods, was it obvious to you that these are people with really amazing technology? And is that kind of a definition for you when someone says God? And we'll get to the various definitions. You actually have five types of gods. But would you say that a God is somebody who's got really high tech?
Well, I mean, I think, and I'm going to speak from the mythological perspective or from a cultural perspective. So In researching cultures, because one of the things that was required was that I needed to find a story in multiple cultures before it made it into the book, and it really was on my radar. And I don't mean Greek and Sumerian. It was like Sumerian and South American, and if I could find an Australian one, I was a happy girl. But anyway, all cultures, or I'm going to say most cultures, have a belief in a supreme deity who created the earth. And I think, you know, in the Western world, we have that underlying belief is of this God that somehow, that we don't know how, created the earth, planets, and the solar system, and, you know, the big picture, the big G God. And do I try to define who that is? No way. You know, and so I'm not even touching that God because I can't. I can't. But when we are talking about the gods of the Bible or the gods that are talked about in mythology, we're not talking about that big G God. These gods were identified as, you know, being able to live extremely long lives and could die. You know, many times they could be brought back to life, but they could die. You know, when we think of God, you know, we think of someone who can, like, wiggle his nose or wink an eye or, you know, nod his head. And whatever we want just kind of goes, oof. I think of Q in Star Trek Next Generation.
Yeah, Q.
He was omnipotent. He could just, like, do something and it would appear. But when we read the mythological record, the gods cannot do that at all. You know, they fly around in some kind of a car or, you know, magical fiery chariot. I mean, that is a common theme, a flying shield. You know, I mentioned that they could die. You know, one of the things that people talk about is they could change forms. And there are a number of narratives, not a ton, but enough for me, sort of, that even in their changing forms, they had some kind of technology. You know, we hear of Freya having a cloak of falcon feathers that allowed her to fly through the skies. There are these Japanese, and I don't remember the name of what they're called, who wore these feathers and would come down from the sky to be on the earth, but if they lost their cloak of feathers, they couldn't go back. You know, so there is this technology base that we find the gods employing in their day-to-day life. And so primitive man or that it was far beyond their comprehension. And even for humanity to write these stories, it was beyond their comprehension as to what these things were.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Can you give us, in your mind, based on your research, what a chronological age would be for the flood? What would you say? Would you say it's the 12,500/9,500, or would you? Because that's the Younger Dryas period. You're not suggesting the flood went for 1,000 years, but I mean, it was a cataclysmic event that pretty much wiped the face of the planet of all civilizations. Mm-hmm. But what would you say was a general date that you have kind of fallen on? What would you feel comfortable with a date? What date?
I mean, the date that seems to pop up in the mythological record is somewhere between 25 and 30,000 BC.
Okay.
You know, and no one's really looked at that time period for flood evidence. What I find interesting, you were talking, you know, before the show about that pyramid being 20, 25,000 BC.
Yeah.
I love when people come up with dates because, you know, Bosnian pyramid is supposedly dated to about 28,000 BC. And
right.
So when the dates start going into that time period, I'm like, I don't think they talk about the rise in sea level, but all of the documentation that you find that has come out, they talk about, well, it rose like, you know, 3 feet in 100 years. I'm like, I'm sorry, that's not a flood.
Yeah.
You can just move your house back, you know, a few feet and you're good.
Yeah. I don't know if you've read any of things by Graham Hancock. He wrote Fingerprints of the Gods, which is like Bible for me. But and his new book is Magicians of the Gods. But his premise is that there was high culture prior to the Younger Dryas period, and following an asteroid hit that created a mass destructive event, including a worldwide flood, and his belief it was 12,500 through 10,000 BC. He believes, and I think there's a lot of evidence for a very, very high culture, possibly the time of Atlantis and other worldwide cultures that had a level of technology that we don't understand. I think we're beginning to understand a little bit now with pyramids like Anun Penang and the Bosnian pyramids and even pyramids in Central America, that they had a different kind of a technology. But wouldn't it be something to consider if majority of the planet was wiped clean of civilization, except for some of these super human types that were still left from these high cultures, who could be considered gods if they were able to salvage some of the technology that they had? Because, you know, if you read Casey's accounts of Atlantis, they had flying machines. They had machines that went underwater. They had machines that flew in the air. The Vimanas of the Hindu cultures, they, you know, those things flew into space and sometimes went to other planets. So they could be considered gods, couldn't they?
And that's a great question, great point, and one that we tackled with writing the book. Huge, huge. You know, because there were a couple of different potentialities. You know, could it be an advanced culture that did have high technology and then they just got deified into gods? I mean, that was one very cogent theory. I mean, Cliff, you have to understand, we did not go into this book going, it's all aliens. We did not. And it took me a few weeks of rumination to finally stop and say, there is no way I can write this book without writing it from its aliens. I just couldn't because it didn't make any sense. Now, I do believe that there was a race of giants that lived, that populated the earth prior to the flood, and I believe that they were one of the groups that the flood annihilated. And could they have been this high culture, high tech group? Very possible. But I still don't think it, according to myth, the gods created them. You know, so, you know, we still have this storyline that goes back prior to that.
Okay. That's very interesting. Well, then I have to ask you, Rita, were you guys able to uncover where these guys came from? Is there like, we came from the, I mean, because the Maya, excuse me, the Hopi have a mythology that a lot of the gods came from the Pleiades. The Mayas believe that too. The Maya also have strong belief in Venus and Mars connection, various beings from those areas. So I'm curious, what did you guys uncover in terms of where some of these better known gods may have come from?
So what we were able to find, direct documented evidence, okay, and I'm not in saying anything about like the Native American stuff, but it's really, in some cultures, it's a little challenging to find books and material. You know, to talk about. You know, the Dogon say Cirrus, you know, boom. They are the clearest about it. But we also find a lot of mythology that takes us to the Pleiades. It takes us, obviously, to Orion, you know, and Orion's belt. Draco comes up, the North Star. And, you know, I hear about Cirrus and Venus. Venus more, or Mars and Venus. I hear, I've seen more about Venus than Mars. And so I feel like all of those are in play. I do not feel like the gods that were here or the cultures and civilizations that were here in deep antiquity were just one race. I mean, the descriptions of the gods, their physical look, are very different. And it would be more coherent or more cogent to say we have different groups that are either fighting with each other and one group taking over the reign of the other group, or we have, you know, multiple planetary civilizations that are all coming to Earth.
So when you say they're fighting, are they fighting for the to have Earth as their one of their domains, or is it more fighting while they're here on the planet?
It is definitely fighting for control. And so depending on what culture you look at, there are stories of heredity. And so I'm going to use Greek because it's, one, I can say their names, which is always nice. And people are more familiar with it. And so when you look at the lineage through the Greeks, it starts off with Uranus. Well, Uranus is one of the progenitors, one of the eight progenitor gods who I believe came to this galaxy, this universe, planetary system originally. Okay. And so it talks about his children, you know, or the Titans and the Cyclopses. And one of them was Cronos. So Cronos fights with his dad. He castrates his dad and basically takes control. Well, Cronos, all right, so the progenitor gods, we don't really know what they look like, you know, and so we don't, there's not a very good feel for them. Cronos, we know, is a fertility god. And what we learned from other cultures is that fertility gods, Enki, fertility gods, are often characterized as the half man, half snake, half man, half serpent. You know, we get that combination. So he takes over control from his dad. And time goes on, and Cronos takes over, and we experience what's called the Golden Age on Earth. Very consistent storyline you find around the world. And so he's here for a long time, and then the next thing, he has children, blah, 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 blah. His son is Zeus. Zeus fights Cronos, and Zeus takes over. But if you look at any pictures of Zeus, excuse my politically incorrect way of saying this, but Zeus is a white guy. You know, and so from an extraterrestrial kind of point of view, it's more like he's a Nordic, you know, mm-hmm. but definitely in a more Caucasian way or okay. Caucasoid form. But even if you look at, you know, and so there are these wars that happen. And I'm just going to kind of take it to the next level. I feel like there is the narrative that we have of God casting Satan out of heaven and sending him into the underworld. You know, that whole Luciferian cast off thing. I believe that that is actually the same narrative, because when Zeus wins the war against Kronos, he sends him and his cronies into the depths of Tartarus. And so that is yet another very consistent storyline that is tied to this war of the sky god against this fertility god, and they end up in the underworld.
That's interesting. Let's talk a little bit about these different gods. You have a section in your book I found was very, very good, which was fascinating, which is the primary gods. And you break them down, and you have the omnipotent creator god. You have the sky father. You have the god of war, the fertility god, the god of the underworld, and the god of, I have strangers to hear, the god of treasure. Which I thought, well, wow, this guy comes down with some gold, and or maybe he... Like Sitchin says in his book, the Anunnaki, their own purpose of being here was to, you know, rid the earth of gold.
Well, you know, we can come back to that, because I wrote an entire chapter just about the stupid gold.
Oh, okay.
Well, a whole chapter on it.
Say it
but
again.
I'll go over the different gods.
What I wanted you to do. Give us an example of each of your subtopic or sub god. Well, omnipresent god is probably going to be a potent god, is going to be Zeus. But give us a name for each of those, would you? Because it's kind of
okay.
It kind of will help. Go ahead.
Okay, so the omnipotent god would be God, that undefinable god that we talked about at the very beginning of the show, the one that I can't explain, you can't explain. Is it a presence? Is it an energy? Are we manifesting that energy? I don't know. It's too big for me to explain. That would be that god. So it's a little bit of review. Sorry. The sky father would be, like using Sumerian, it would be Anu. You
know, Anu would be a sky father? Is that because he flew in a machine? Is that because he flew?
Because it is claimed by many that at some point in time he may have walked the earth, but they haven't seen him in a long time.
Okay.
And so he is the guy in charge. You know, the way that I ended up kind of characterizing it was like a CEO and his department heads. And so Anu is the CEO. He's the big boss. He is the guy in charge of all of these extraterrestrial guys.
Okay.
So he's the big guy. And so the god of war would be your Zeus. You know, these are the people that are typically associated with thunder and lightning and the lightning spear. So Chakmul, Tiamat, or not Tiamat, but that character, the ones associated with lightning. The god of fertility would be your Enki. It would be your Kazakh Wotel. The god of the underworld would be Hades, you know, those guys. Anyway, and then the god of treasures, it depends on what cosmology, if that fourth group appears. That fourth group appears as a god in Indian cosmology and in some other ones. But it falls out in Greek. These were lesser gods. Interestingly, the gods of treasures are always characterized as being either giants or dwarfs. They traditionally live in the mountains, not in the underworld, but in the mountains. And they are associated with either hoarding treasures, mining, and or being the builders of the technology. So in India, one of these gods built the Sabas, which is the heaven. It is the, you know, like the Star Imperial rover from Star Wars. You know, they built these homes for the gods. There were five of them, which we found a consistency of four or five giant, and I mean, the only word I can use is ships, that hundreds of thousands of people lived in. You know, so we're talking big, big. But these gods of treasures, were the master builders. They're the ones that built, they constructed the lightning weapon. In India, that lightning weapon is called the Vihara that Indra used. You know, it can level mountains, not something I would want to get in its way.
Right.
But they're the ones that were the engineers and the builders for the gods. And so really the reality is Zeus didn't ever make anything. He would go to these other guys and go, hey, make me something cool.
Oh, interesting. I think, don't you characterize Zeus as like a CEO of a company?
Well, I mean, he is the guy who is in charge of the earth.
Okay.
You know, but that's his, he's in charge of the sky, and I'm going to say he's in charge of the surface of the earth, because when you have, if you think about it, like Neptune is in charge of the watery deep, Enki, the watery deep.
Right.
Then you have Hades, he's in charge of the underworld, and so Zeus is, I mean, he's in charge, but it's kind of a loose in charge kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in Greek mythology, they get rid of the over god, where in some cultures they have it, some of them they don't. I mean, that's the thing, why it ended up like an Excel spreadsheet, was some things were important to certain cultures, and so you end up with that narrative and pieces, and some things maybe not so much. You know, and so one of the things we tried to do in the book was create, you know, and I'm going to say the narrative, but really what I'm doing is just repeating the mythology to give you different perspectives of the chronology based on the mythology, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Interesting.
You know, so it gets a little choppy, you know, culture to culture, but when you look in a big enough depth and breadth, you really see the commonality. And I have to tell you, Cliff, I mean, in writing this, I'd be working on a section, you know, and trying to figure out, you know, like trying to figure out why do some cultures have five cycles of time, like India, there's four, and in Mesoamerica, there's five. And I would sit there, and I would be talking to Wayne and going, and I felt like a slot machine. And my eyes with these myths were just like rolling and rolling and rolling and rolling in my head, and I just wanted the 777 to appear. I swear to God, but when it did, it was like, oh, I get it. And
interesting.
Then I'd have to write it down because I'd forget probably.
That's fascinating. If you were to go to some of the ancient ruins that have anomalous structures, I'll give you a few. Baalbek, Lebanon, with their megaliths that weigh into the thousands of tons, and they can't figure out how anyone moved. In fact, today we'd have trouble moving them. Teotihuacan, the massive pyramids that are engineered to perfection. Easter Island with its monstrous megaton sculptures. If you were to look at each one of those locations, would you could after writing this book, could you say, well, that kind of fits this god, or this kind of fits this god, or because of the technology, you know, maybe it was these people. Can you use that your research as a kind of a fine point to determine who may have put these places together?
That's a great question, and one no one's ever asked me. It does not appear as if the gods really ever lived on the surface of the planet. And so I don't think that the structures that we find belong to these gods. How's that for an answer? Now, I do believe there was a more advanced culture that did build this stuff. You know, and I was talking about the giants. I think that that is entirely possible. You know, that it came from that race. Let me just throw my little gold thing in. I don't know where we are time wise, so I'll just throw my little gold thing in.
Oh, you're good. No, we're good. We're rolling.
Okay. I mean, one of the things, you know, like Sitchin, you know, I read all of his books and I thought he was a cat's meow until I started writing this book, and then
this is good. I was going to ask you about your feeling about the Nephilim and all this kind of stuff. But, very interested.
That's a totally different topic. Save that one.
Well, tell me what you think of Sitchin, because I'm always interested.
Well, you know, his books are written in a very scholarly format, which I love. You know, I love books that have meat. I love books that are deep. And I kind of have like books that are a little on the dry side. I don't know why, but I do. Anyway, so when I was writing the book, I got to where they were on the earth and they were, you know, the narrative starts. But, you know, you get to that question of why were they here? Why did they choose to come here? So that was what the question I wanted to answer. And so I kind of assumed that Sitchin knew what he was talking about. I hate talking derogatory because I feel like he brought forward a lot of great work. And so I kind of was going with the gold thing. That worked for me. I didn't have anything to dispute it, but I couldn't find it. Cliff, I spent a month, 10 to 12 hours a day, to the point where I'd get up from my computer and I couldn't see.
Okay, wait a minute.
My eyes were just like...
So you're saying that, and this is a big point, his reasoning for the Anunnaki to come to Earth was to do gold digging. And you're saying in your research, you found no evidence of that?
I could not find in the mythological record any references or very few references to gold. It is interesting. And, you know, and I was digging and I was digging and I was digging, you know, because Lawrence Gardner talks about the monatomic gold, and that's what they use to stay young and for immortality. And
immortality.
So he says, you know, it's Mifka. I don't know. It's just a bunch of consonants, however you would pronounce it. And I was digging and looking at myths and looking for gold mines and looking for, and not finding it. I mean, I just wasn't finding it from Sumerian sources, nothing. You know, all I was looking for was a thing that said they, you know, went and dug gold. You know, anything, praise to the gold. I mean, I was pretty open to anything gold, no gold.
Yeah. Wow.
And so even when I started, let me just finish up with the gold part, and then I'll go on to the next piece. Finally, because I was looking for that Mifka thing, and when you start digging around, all you find is basically the same two people's work written over and over again. One is Sitchin's work talking about the Anunnaki coming for gold. And just for anybody listening, the Lost Book of Enki is not a real tablet. It is his interpretation of what the history is. So if you read the second to last paragraph of the introduction, it says, it is my interpretation. And you can't take what is in there and say, this is what the text say. This was how frustrated I was. I finally pulled out my Sitchin book. It's like, well, he had to have referenced where he got the material, where he got the gold.
I was just going to say, where did he reference his material?
And
yeah,
so finally I found, his thought around the gold was there is a word that is Semitic, that is Zuah. There was this word Zuah, and if you turn it around the other way, it says Abzu, and Zuah is named gold. You know, don't quote me on it. I think it's in his first book. Mm-hmm. And then tied to that was a cuneiform image that I guess could look like a drill, like a drill bit.
Mm-hmm.
And that was it.
Well, that's very, very interesting.
It's weak. It's weak. I was
me. He kind of massaged the material, is what you're saying.
Well,
so,
I came up with a slightly different take on it. So, but anyway, but no, I was shocked. I'm like, he based his entire premise of all of this on that crappy piece of information? I was shocked.
Boy.
I was shocked.
Wow.
Anyway, you know, and then the whole Lawrence Gardner thing here, I'm dishing it today. He kept talking about them finding this monatomic gold in this cave in Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
And I had found, like, when I first started this book, an article about this monatomic gold being found in a cave in Egypt. And I saved it, so I couldn't find it. And then I couldn't find the article online again. And but I'm figuring it was a Lawrence Gardner article at this point. But I finally found the archaeologist who was the one that actually went into the cave. It was like in 1939, and you get the text, and the book says mm-hmm. he went into the cave and there was white powder.
Okay.
Not monatomic gold, just white powder. And then continuing in my digging, I found a site that translated Egyptian, and that Mithka word came up as meaning turquoise or precious metal or precious stone, something mm-hmm. like that. Well,
wow.
The cave that it was found in was in Hatshepsut's cave, which was a turquoise mine.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
My comment, too, after an entire frickin' month of digging.
Wow.
But anyway, but what I did uncover was actually very interesting. So I started digging around for mining. I'm like, well, you know, because Michael Tellinger talks about the 200,000-year-old gold mine, the Lion's Mine or something like that in South Africa. So I started looking up mines.
Yeah.
Well, apparently that Lion's Mine, from what I was seeing, wasn't a gold mine. It was an ochre mine, you know, like red ochre that's used for paint or whatever. So I started digging around with that because I'm going, well, that's kind of interesting, because what I found was the three oldest and biggest mines found around the world were all ochre mines. South America or South Africa. In South America, you're going to love this one, by Nazca. And the third one was in Australia.
Wait a minute. South
America,
it's Nazca. Did you say Nazca, Peru?
Nazca, Peru. It has this one of the second biggest and oldest ochre mines.
I wonder what the heck is so important about ochre that they would go and then drill into the... Okay.
Well, let me just keep going.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if you think of gold, what would we use it for? We use it for jewelry, which I'm not like, you know, feeling the gods with that one. We use it for electronics. You know, and I kind of didn't think that they had cell phones. And the third reason that it is used is for shielding. Did I dance
shielding.
Like that?
Yeah.
You know, like, you know, space stuff, it's used for shielding, which is, that's probably the piece that Sitchin leaned onto, because it's highly reflective, you know,
right.
And it doesn't tarnish and stuff like that. And Well, one of the things that I found interesting about ochre is that ritually, people will apply ochre to their body, and it is seen as being beautiful. Or if you think about the Aborigines in Australia, you know how they always have that white stuff on themselves in ritual? Well, it's white ochre. You know, if you think about ancient burial practices, the bodies were covered in red ochre. And I will say one really good thing about Ancient Aliens. They talked about this one story about El Dorado, not where El Dorado wasn't a location, but El Dorado was a person. In it's in Peru, or I'm not sure if it's in Peru, but it's in South America, but kind of in that area. And the legend has it, or the story has it, was that they would once a year take a fine gold dust and cover the leader with a gold powder. And he would go into, it has to be, because he went into the center of, I think, Lake Titicaca and did these ceremonies. And when he was done with the ceremonies, he would jump into the water and the festivities would begin. Well, through some deductive reasoning, I thought, well, perhaps the gods didn't spend much time on the surface of the earth because they had issues with the ultraviolet radiation. Because what is one of the things that ochre is good for? It's a great sunscreen. And could the ochre be worn by humans trying to emulate the gods?
Right.
You know, if the gods are running around with gold stuff on their skin, or the lesser gods who aren't, you know, aren't rich, are running around with ochre on their skin, you know, did that continue in our cultural, you know, this
heritage.
Is something important?
Yeah.
You know, and then if you even take it one more level, think about death masks. You know, you think about King Tut's mask, or you think about, you know, the Greek mask that they wore, that they buried them with. You know, in Egyptian cosmology, they wore the death mask, the gold death mask, so that they could look more godlike. And as they go through the Egyptian Book of the Dead, that they would be recognized as a god and be allowed to get through all of the tribulations. And so, again, were the gods coating themselves with gold? And we think that, you know, our iteration of it was, well, we need to wear these death masks so that we can look more godlike, because that's what the gods were doing at one point in time. But if it's just an imaginary god, you know, that's just a figment of my imagination, then why would we want to cover ourselves with gold to look like a god that we've never seen? I don't know.
Amazing. Very strange. I want to talk a little bit about a chapter that I've always found fascinating. And it, you have it, you call it the gods and the tool and their toys. And and it's fun because there's, and I know this in Hindu, the Vamanas and other cultures talk about their flying crafts and weapons of mass destruction, these lightning bolts and these lasers and stuff like that. Tell us a little bit about how the myths kind of describe these this technology.
Well, I mean, it's pretty amazing, that's for sure. Well, I mean, you know, I was talking about the ships. It seems as if, you know, and I'm going to use contemporary vernacular to talk about this, but it seems as if the gods, I'm going to back up. So the gods, they stories talk of these five, and I'm going to say motherships, four or five motherships that were owned by the sky god, the sky father, the fertility god, and the god of the underworld. And these ships could travel anywhere at the will of the owner. And to get to and from, in particular to the sky god's location, they utilized smaller craft, you know, so that's where we have, you know, like Zeus's chariots and, you know, people climbing onto a cloud and flying off, or, you know, the Ezekiel thing, all that good stuff. But they were used more for more local travel. You know, and you would think if they were godlike, they would have teleporters. I mean, what's with that? I don't know. Anyway. But the big shift, I mean, according to the Indian text, it talks about them being like, you know, 5 miles in length. And I mean, they were huge. And, you know, 10 miles in width. But then, you know, we have that Vimana-like weapon that was used to, and I'm just trying to find the quote real quick. So this one, it is, I think it's the same weapon, but this one came from the exploits of Nutora, which is a Sumerian story, and it talks about his mace. Okay, so this Vihara thing, which is a three-pronged staff thing. I have an article on it on soulhealer.com. You can learn all about just the Vihara. Anyway.
Okay.
But it is sometimes referred to as a club or several other things. An axe, like Thor, had a Vihara-like object. But this is Nutora's, and so it says, the mace snarled at the mountains. The club began to devour all the enemy. He lifted the evil wind and the Scirocco on a pole. He placed the quiver on its hook. An enormous hurricane, irresistible, went before the hero, stirring up dust, caused the dust to settle, leveled high and low, filled with holes. It caused a rain of coals and flaming fires. The fire consumed men. It overturned tall trees by their trunks, reducing the forest to heaps. So that's one example of what this thing could do. Or I think it's the same weapon, but another description. And I'll just pull one sentence. It projected so strong a ray of light that eyes were blinded by it.
Wow.
Like, ow.
That's pretty potent technology. Yeah.
That's pretty potent technology. You know, and it must have been important because that is probably, that weapon in particular is the most consistent weapon of mass destruction that we find in mythology. You know, we find the ships and that weapon.
If you can imagine going to war against someone with a weapon like that, it's basically over because you're taking out, you know, huge hunks of mountains and stuff like that. What's that going to do to a human body? It's going to wipe out everybody.
Well, I mean, but you start reading, you know, other texts, you know, that one was pretty potent. But like in the Ramayana, Rama had a bow and he could shoot like 1,000 arrows at a time and they all would hit their target. You know, so it wasn't like that was the only weapon. But it's the one that definitely got the most press. I would say that.
Is there any craft that was most impressive to you? I mean, obviously, Vimana is the most well-known ancient craft. There's been various documents that have come forth that claim that was run with mercury and it created some kind of electromagnetic pulse and so on and so forth.
No evidence. From the mythological.
That's all BS. Letters. Yeah.
You know, and even that Vimana book that is supposedly out there that David Childress talks about.
Yeah, exactly.
From what I understand, it was written in the 1700s.
Right.
So I don't know that anybody had a Vimana hanging around. Anyway,
yeah.
You know, well, I just want to make a comment, which I don't know if it came through in what we've been talking about. There are a lot of people that believe that there were all of these gods and that different cultures had different gods that they were talking about. And my belief is when we start reading these stories, we had one group of gods, and we're just telling the same stories about these same gods. You know, mm-hmm. So when we talk about this Vihara weapon, it's because that weapon was wielded by this person, and whether this person was in South America, whether this person was in the Middle East, whether he was in the UK, doesn't matter. It's the same person wielding the same weapon.
Interesting. And is that your belief? Is that all these cultures had all these different gods and demigods, and they're all kind of the same ones, but that they all experienced? What's your feeling?
Yes.
Okay,
yes,
that's very cool.
Basically, well, I mean, because even if you start looking at, like my movie Icon, Deconstructing the Archetypes of the Ancients, really starts looking at the commonality from an artistic perspective. Okay, because you can look at the mythological part, but from an artistic perspective, it becomes even, to me, clearer. And I'll just give one very simple example. In Sumerian art, Enki is always portrayed, or a lot of the times portrayed, as having these three, like, wavy lines coming off of his shoulders. So you can always tell if you see some Sumerian guy with these three wavy lines coming off of his shoulders, that's Enki. And that's what's called iconography. A person is drawn in a certain way, and then you can tell who it is. Simple example. All right, here's a question for you, Cliff. I'm going to describe somebody, and you tell me just based on his iconography if you can tell who it is, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it's a kind of portly gentleman, and he wears a red suit. And just stop me when you know, and
and it's that time of year for him to be around, too.
That's right, okay?
Yeah.
And so just from those three pieces, you know exactly who I'm talking about, right?
Oh my God! There's a. Are you serious about Saint Nick on this? Is he a demigod we don't know about?
No. Well, maybe, but it's just from that mentality, and so we can take Santa and make him skinny, and you know, the thing is, you know where he lives, you know how he gets around, you know the names of all of his pets. You know his wife's name. You know who builds for him. You know kind of what his house looks like. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
We know
yeah.
all of this information. Well, that was how information was communicated in antiquity. And so having that picture of Enki, it's like people knew all about Enki. You know, and if you saw that guy with the three wavy lines, it's like, oh, that's Enki, and this is where he lives, and this is what he does, and blah, 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 just like Santa. We have that whole story narrative.
Okay. Well, I want to repeat this again, because you brought up something that I have not thought about, which is that the gods and the demigods and maybe even their offspring are repeated in different cultures, and you're suggesting that they're the same group of people. That is pretty profound for me. And I have not thought about that before, and I don't know if anyone else has ever brought that up, and maybe you've run across some academic papers that I can't think of one, and I'm not a scholar, so I wouldn't be one to be able to find it and research it, but that is pretty profound what you're saying.
But it makes sense because we find so many commonalities around the world. And so if we have one group that's doing this stuff, we're going to have one set of results. So let me just continue with my little example. So we have Enki, three little wavy things. Well, in South America, they have a fertility god or a water god. I forget. I think they call him a water god. He doesn't have a name. When you look at the picture, guess what he has coming off of his shoulders? Three wavy lines. You know, and you find that over and over and over again. And so, you know, that's what that whole film is about, is here's this image here, and here's this derivation. But if we go across the country or the world finding the same imagery with very similar it's kind of like the Noah story with very similar characteristics tied to it.
You know, let's talk about this movie, Icon, Deconstructing the Archetypes of the Ancients. Why was it kind of was the book not fulfilling enough and you needed to create a movie on this research or what? Why create a movie?
Well, I mean, I kind of like making movies. I've created actually like 15 different ones. This was actually a full length. Most of my other ones are about 15 minutes in length. This is actually a full length, hour long movie.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And because one of my big things is looking at the commonality in myth, the commonality in art. I mean, one of the things that I'm sure you're aware of, if you think of like Sacsayhuaman or what's going on in Cusco, you look at that rock carving, you know, and you can't put a piece of paper between it, but it has some very characteristic aspects to it. You know, the rocks are just kind of weird shape, you know, it looks like a puzzle piece, and there's that who knows why beveling around the edge, you know, it's just kind of rounded around the seams. And so it's very distinct and characteristic of Sacsayhuaman. However, we find that same characteristic in several other places. We find it on Easter Island, which, of all places on the planet, we find that in China, you know, and I don't have the other places off the top of my head, but like the myths, we find, you know, art, you can always tell, we can tell the difference between modern art and Egyptian art pretty easy. You know, we can tell something that is Chinese versus Western. You know, I mean, we can separate those just based on the style. And for people that are really into it, they can tell who the artist is just by their style. So for a lot of people, if Vincent van Gogh, his artwork is very characteristic, you know, Starry, Starry Night with those big swirling brush prints. No one else really has replicated his art or would try to. And so the same thing with architecture. You know, people have their style. And I feel like we find certain architectural styles in different places around the world. And so what, you know, it's just this continuation of there are these commonalities. It's not just in myth. Look, it's in our art. It's culture. You know, the storyline that goes with it. And one of my personal feelings tied to it is, okay, so I believe that the character that we find in Peru that is nameless is really Enki, you know, or the character we know in Sumeria as Enki. And so can we start taking what we do know, you know, from this area and start applying it to what we don't know in another culture? Something I have not pursued, but I would, you know, love for someone to pick that up.
Right.
And go, okay, you know, because I think we could learn more. We know kind of Enki's story. We don't know this fertility god's story, but do they have the same story? And what's the implication of that?
I have not had a chance to see this movie, Icon, but it sounds like it goes into quite a bit about artistic representation and that being a key element to deciphering, apparently, evidence of ancient culture, gods, or not only that, just understanding symbology and art through different cultures, kind of using the same representation. Is that correct?
That would be a very good assessment. And I'll just say, only $1.99 on Amazon.com.
Wow, that is cheap. I'll post it on the site. We'll make sure we get it up. on the website. I want to ask you one or two last questions just to get your hit on this.
Okay.
In your book, you describe the age of planets in our known universe. And I'm very fascinated with Mars, and you talk a little bit about Mars and show the face of Mars, which is hugely, hugely controversial, not only with current science, but with, I would say, scientists who are not in the mainstream. And we've had Dr. John Brandenburg on the program, and I don't know if you know who he is, but...
I mean, I know who he is, but I haven't had him on my show.
Okay. But he did an analysis and created a paper that was presented to a number of space scientists at a NASA-sponsored event a couple of years ago, in which he hypothesized that the beings on the surface of the planet were destroyed, or basically it was a genocidal event where two massive, massive nuclear bombs were detonated in the atmosphere and basically wiped the planet clean of all living matter, perhaps destroyed the atmosphere and caused Mars to become a dead planet. The thing that's unique about his analysis is, and he was a weapons expert and understood and does understand nuclear fusion, he believes, based on the half-life of the particles that make up a nuclear bomb, that this civilization lived millions upon millions of years ago. And he doesn't really talk about it, but Graham Hancock talks about evidence of Mars beings populating Earth, in particular pre-dynastic Egypt, because there's evidence of pyramids and even in a couple places Sphinx-like structures, sculptures. What's your feeling on that? I mean, I kind of tend to think so in many ways. And this would have to be populating or visiting the Earth, you know, tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, or perhaps millions of years ago, which would radically change our understanding of early Earth. And it would be blow everyone's mind if the Great Pyramid was dated to be, say, a million years, you know. But I'm just curious because you don't really, you know, you kind of hint there, you know, the god of Mars or the gods of Mars, but you don't really say there's a god of Mars who may have come and is considered a god. But what's your feeling on that? What's your feeling about Mars and the Earth connection?
You know, the whole Mars thing came in a very interesting way. I'm just going to say in a very interesting way.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you look at, and this was a problem I was trying to solve, and Mars seemed as a likely candidate as anything else. When you look at cultures, and I mentioned this earlier, there are cultures that talk about four cycles of time, such as in India, and cultures that talk about five cycles of time, such as in Mesoamerica. And when you start looking at what those cycles of time state, they talk about that the gods, the progenitor gods, came to this planet in a cosmic egg, and they created a race of beings. And this world is described as being dark or semi-dark. And the race of beings rebel, or they're not being subservient, and a war happens, and it's annihilated. Okay, and then the next cycle talks about a golden age, you know, and everything is great and hunky-dory. Well, in cultures that only have four cycles of time, they always start with a golden age. So they kind of dropped off that piece of cosmology.
Hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And so my question was, okay, so if there was going to be a culture that preceded life on Earth, because now we're talking about a dark or semi-dark planet, you know, and I'm kind of cringing here because, I mean, this was just, You know, if I was going to say there was something I pulled out of my butt, this would be the part. But it freaking worked, Cliff. So I said, okay, so we have a planet that's dark, semi-dark. Okay, so where could that be? And just goofing around, I said, well, what about Mars? And I said, okay, you know, there's a face on Mars, but no, it gets more interesting. So I said, well, let me just go see. I mean, would it fit in with my timeline? Well, so our solar system started to develop about 4.5 billion years ago. Mm-hmm. And around 2 million years, and I'm trying to find the golden age. I'm trying to find my exact numbers here so I can be more clear. So within a couple of million years, okay, here it is. In less than 2 million years, even to the astonishment of researchers, Mars's environment was dramatically different from what was evolving on Earth during the same period. And so this was 4.5 billion years ago minus 2 million years. So within the very beginning of Mars's development, it was developing differently. And it was during this period, which was called the Nokian period, that scientists have agreed that if life could have been possible on Mars, it would have been during this period.
That's what I thought.
That's
fascinating.
Yeah. And so I said, okay, but you know, we have this war or a rebellion that happened. And so during that time, Mars experienced what was called the late heavy bombardment. So, I mean, it was just blasted with meteors and stuff. And it started to lose the dynamo in the center of the planet, thus it started to lose its atmosphere. Now, my feeling was that it was during that period that this group of rebels, so this would have been Cronos in Greek mythology, you know, usurped Uranus, and basically he took off. Okay, and there is myth to support that there was a separation, he went somewhere else. And so my thought was, well, maybe he came to Earth. Well, when all of this all was happening was around 3.8 billion years ago. And guess when life started miraculously, because they don't know how, on Earth?
Mm-hmm.
3.8 billion years ago. Poof! Just like
wow.
That.
That's interesting.
Well, and what's interesting is, you know, when water, iron oxide, ochre, is formed when oxygen metabolizes with iron in the environment. And so, you know, my thought is one of the reasons that the surface of Mars has that red color to it is because iron oxide was formed, ochre was formed during that process. It was the formation of ochre that actually led to the planet becoming a planet where we could breathe the oxygen. And that's a whole scientific thing, but it's a fact. So
fascinating.
You know,
well,
so
hey,
I mean, it was just kind of this like weird thing out of my butt, but it worked for me.
Hey, we appreciate it. Hey, so we've been talking to Rita Louise, and the book, I would suggest you get it. It's a good book. It's E.T. Chronicles, What Myth and Legend Tells Us About Human and Human Origin. And then the movie, when did the movie come out? Was that fairly recently?
At this point in time, it was last year, right around this time last year.
Okay, and that's called Icon, this, Deconstructing the Archetypes of the Ancients, and I gotta check that out. It looks like a really
$1.99.
Yeah, and that's a hell of a good price. That is sounds like a really something cool to check out. I also want people to know that Rita's the host of Just Energy Radio. You can hear her. How many times a week are you on?
Thursday night. I would suggest people go to the website because we've been doing a whole bunch of changes. And, justenergyradio.com. Mm-hmm. Or my main website is soulhealer.com. If you want to check out some of those articles that I was talking about, the Bihara or the Who is the Author of Myth article and stuff.
Right. Sounds great. Hey, well, listen, it's been a pleasure, and we want to have you on again. And keep up the great work. You are really an explorer in a big sense of the word with your research. And this this book is fascinating. I'm going to really, really jump into it. And I'm sorry to hear about Wayne passing away. I didn't realize that until I started reading the book. He just passed recently, so...
2 years ago.
Okay.
Well, I mean, what was interesting is we got the book deal like the month he was diagnosed. And he goes, see, you're going to be a millionaire. And I'm like, okay, I'm good with that.
Anyhow, it's a great book, and it's a good read, and it's a fun read too. So thank you, Rita. And
thank you.
Continued success.
Thanks, Cliff. Thanks for having me on.
Okay, fantastic. We'll be in touch. So that was Rita, and that is it for today. I want you to make sure that you have a chance to check out our constant information on Facebook. Facebook, go to Earth Ancients Group, and then we have an international page, Facebook, Earth Ancients, which is just the site that is picked up with most of the search engines around the world. And I am constantly posting information and archives, and also everybody who is on the radio program. So do check those out. Have a great day, and we will talk to you next time.